Fennelly on London Finance and the Regions, where we have three star speakers. We've got for you Danny Dorling, who is by any standards the most visually imaginative geographer in the UK, because you know anybody who reads Danny's stuff knows that it's the illustrations, the infographics, all the rest of that stuff which gives what he has to say an extra special edge. We've also got Nick Shackson of the Tax Justice Network, known to many of you as the author of Treasure Island, the best book on tax havens yet written, and he's going to talk about his current ideas about the finance curse. And from the back, and as a reminder that London isn't just Canary Wharf, we have Alan Sitkin from Enfield Council. Fresh off the front page of The Guardian yesterday, and as I understand it from my sources, Chukwuemunna's office, after yesterday morning's coverage of Enfield's housing policy, rang up the Labour leader of Enfield Council and said, "You are going ahead of national policy." And a jolly good thing, too. Many of us misthink. So there we are, three interesting speakers, starting with Danny, and I'm going to keep this strictly to 20 minutes and warn 5 minutes before the end. Danny, take it away.
Thank you very much. You'll be pleased to know I've only got 8 slides, because I thought it was 10 minutes. So if I'm talking slowly at some point, so I think that gives it away. But it'll let me ramble a little bit, more than you normally ramble, because a lot of what we have to do is simply speculation when you're dealing with a subject like this. Partly because of the title of Kresh, I thought I'd have some sort of cultural images in the beginning. I particularly like these two pictures. Of course you can pick any pictures from any time and suggest they have great meaning, but what matters about these pictures is that they were published in national newspapers at the time, and of course particularly the bottom one has been repeated very often. And when I see these pictures, I think of modern day bankers, and I think of the pictures around about 2005-2006 of bankers celebrating London, buying the glass of champagne with a diamond in it, admittedly had a diamond, for $10,000, and all those kind of celebrating of financial success images that you got in the papers that you're never going to see again. You occasionally get stories about people going to nightclubs, but you no longer get the kind of photographs of that kind of era. And this is part of my optimism about, I think things are changing. And I think part of the reason we don't think they're changing is because the change is so uniform that we don't notice it. So there's a moral change over what's seen as acceptable and decent. And it's a general change, and so we don't think anything's happening because you don't notice change if all of you are changing at the same time. I'll try and give you one more example, and then I will explain the significance of these pictures. A couple of years ago I went to Norway, and I was doing a talk in Oslo about child poverty, and I made the mistake of opening up my talk by saying, "Congratulations, you've got the lowest rate of child poverty in the world," to which 3 members of the audience objected that I was such an idiot, and I didn't realise that child poverty was still a problem in Norway. Now, the reason Norway has the lowest rate of child poverty in the world is because they're bothered about child poverty. It's a general ethos, it's a different way of thinking. Part of the reason why the United States has one of the highest rates of child poverty in the rich world is that people are less bothered. It's simply what happens to you if your parents don't work hard enough. That top picture was taken a few months before the outbreak of the First World War. And those young men are from Harrow School. You can tell Harrow School because they've got the cane, if you ever need to know if the boys from Harrow are after Eton. That's the way to do it. And you kind of see the brash confidence there. Now that was just before the outbreak of the First World War and at the height of inequality. My favourite measure of inequality is the 1%. It correlates remarkably well with the Gini coefficient. It's the share of national income that the top 1% take, and it peaked at around 25%. And you probably know the pattern, and it's a pattern you can see in many other graphs of change over time. And we're back to around about 15% if you put in estimates of the tax dodging at the top. If you don't put in estimates of the tax dodging at the top, you get around 30%. After tax, it's about 10% that the top 1% are taking, and it had one of the biggest increases in years last year, in figures released by Inland Revenue. So the 1% are moving away again. It had a little dent after 2008. The US 1% take about 20% of all income, leaving 60% of the other 99% of people in the US. In the Netherlands, as a figure from 2 years ago, I think it's about 6%. 1% taken in Netherlands. So there's a huge span of inequality. Now the lower picture was taken in 1936 and it's iconic because the two posh boys look nervous. That's why, and the local boys look cocky. So it's a change in attitude, a change in time. That's why the picture's carried on being iconic and being used. Sadly, one of those rich boys died within a year, and the other one, I think, ended up in an asylum and died about in his 60s, I think. Whereas I think the last time I heard, a couple of years ago, all three of those other lads were doing fine. So, I mean, and that's a change in British society. I mean, you know, it's an extreme example. There's also huge class divisions between those three poorer boys. We know from the census records that the shorter one, who's scowling slightly, lived in a house with half as number of rooms per person as the better off working class boy. Well, you see, I'm obsessed by these particular pictures. But the point of showing them is that if you look at the graph, you can see this incredible drop in inequality that occurred before the Second World War, before 1939. Now, during that period, from 1913 to 1939, you have no record, I think, and I'd love it if you can tell me I'm wrong about this, no record of people celebrating the fact the turning point had happened, all the great social achievements that were going on, and that we were heading towards a wonderful new world, because you can't spot a turning point when you're at a turning point. There were obviously a whole series of things that mattered. I think Ireland going wasn't insignificant. The Russian Revolution helped enormously to concentrate minds of people at the top. The trade unions were more powerful. Mass unemployment had an effect, and of course people fighting together in the war taught them something about each other rather than assuming you knew about other people by talking to your servants. But that was the last change, and of course we're currently heading upwards and wondering about whether we're at a turning point again. Inequality dulls your senses in all kinds of ways and makes you accept things which are strange. These are PISA figures for ability of 16 to 24 year olds at numeracy, which are about the most comparable things you can measure, because numeracy is numeracy in most countries of the world, whereas literacy, some languages are harder than others. And there we are. And also these are nice figures because they're taken after school. So it's not about whether you've got a school system that's very good at getting people to pass exams in one day. This is the average level of numeracy of young adults. And the relationship between inequality, those are some of the most equal countries at the top, in the rich world, and here's some of the most unequal ones. And numeracy is very, very close. So one problem you have is that as you become more unequal, your population becomes less numerate, less understanding, more willing to buy into the idea that their children will be rich because they'll win the lottery or somehow become a basketball player or something. Whereas in a more equal country, people are cleverer across the board and so can control the people at the top better. The 1% don't get out of control. My other little graph up there doesn't have the UK on, sadly, but it's a composite statistic along the side called self-enhancement, which, to put it very simply, is the rate at which people big themselves up and say they're great in surveys. So it's those kind of surveys where you ask, are you an over average driver? And see how many people in particular countries say that thing. And it's, I'm trying to get into the cultural side of this. In a very unequal country at a very unequal time, it's not surprising that you don't have more anger about it, because large numbers of the population simply don't understand what percentages are, or what billions are compared to millions. And you have an attitude that you've got to work hard and try hard to be a survivor. If you don't make it, it's your own fault, and that's much more common in more unequal places than more equal places. But there is dissent. That particular image there, of various professions sized by their salaries, is an example of dissent. And I think an example of that changing mood that I was trying to describe to you.
Can you explain the
self-enhancement?
Yeah, again, and the self-enhancement scale.
It's a standard. They took six different measures of how much people said on average that they were good at things, you know, and put them together and averaged them. So it's from another paper.
So if more people say they're better than average driver, that correlates.
Then you get a higher scale, yeah. But they didn't have the data for the UK to be able to put the UK on. There's a theory that says to get through life in a place like Los Angeles, you have to wake up in the morning and think, I'm good, I'm going to go for it. I'm going to try and things will be better in the future for my children. So even if I am going to find it hard, it'll be better for the children. Because if you have a realistic attitude, it's pretty dire. You know, half of California, well, all of California actually, but certainly half, in all of California, I think you're more likely to go to prison than to go to university. So if you have a newborn baby, particularly, you know, do you look at the baby and go, you know, you don't. But you don't need to have that optimism in a more equal country, because your children are probably going to be okay. And the one who does best is not going to become very rich, but the one who does worse is not going to end up in the gutter. Ending up in the gutter, another picture from the past. If you add two noughts to this, you get equivalent to now. The one difference is, if the Institute for Physical Studies are correct, then as of last year, when they measured inequality between 99% of people in this country has reduced, income inequality, back to the levels of John Major. Because of things like losing child benefit if you're in the top 10%, and other tax changes and so on, but also because wages came down. It's only the 1% moving away that means our overall inequality rate's moving away. So it's the man with the top hat is actually stepping up the ladder. Everybody else is stepping down. But of course, if you're at the bottom, it means soup kitchens again. Stepping down. To be in the 1%, if you're wondering if you're in it, you need an income of 160,000 in your household. I'm going to zoom forward. Another little image there, the endangered species image, comes from the United States. And again, these are sort of changing times. There's an old image from the 1970s. Here's a new one that I had to go doing, trying to look at wealth distribution, which is almost impossible to look at because, again, the 1% are much better at hiding their wealth even than their income. But that's an attempt to look at how uneven the wealth distribution of the UK is. I need to get on to finance and the regions. This is my cue to do this. We took the rise in the value of residential property in the whole of 2003, according to the Land Registry, multiplied it by the number of properties in each London borough and each region, and then drew a map. And you'll see London is larger than the whole of Yorkshire, Humberside, North East and the North West, and the middle of London is bigger than the whole series of other boroughs. So that's a bubble. That looks like a bubble. That rise is slower than the rise so far in 2014. So it's a bubble that's getting bigger, faster. Lots of newspaper stories telling you it's slowing down. No data. No actual prices yet. Slightly lower asking prices in August as more people piled into the London market and put their property for sale. But so far, despite desperate attempts by Carney and so on to talk the market down, because they do not want to crash before the election, there is no slowdown. We're about 17% housing inflation a year. So the silly thing there is showing you you get average property prices of 10 million if that carries on by 2033. It's obviously going to crash at some point before 2033. It's just past 500,000 now. So why? What's going on? One thing that's going on, and this gets me back to London and the regions, is that young people are still flooding into London. They're flooding into London faster than ever before. Part of it is because, of course, public sector jobs have been going up in London let alone all the private sector jobs. But a bigger thing than this is that jobs have become more precarious. You don't expect to have a career if you're in your 20s with a single job for a long time. So you need to be somewhere where there are other jobs for when you lose your job. Add on top of that that housing's becoming more precarious. You're going to have to rent. So again, you want to be somewhere where you've got options to renting. And then add in the fact that you're probably going to want a partner, boyfriend or girlfriend, because you won't be able to afford to rent unless you've got a partner. And you need to be somewhere that can provide jobs for two people. And then that suddenly means that it's no good being out in Oxford. Reading's okay. Oxford's actually too far, let alone Sheffield. And so what we're getting is an ever-increased draw of people, young people, to London faster than ever before, helping to sell those bedsits, or at least to keep the rents very high up and encourage the landlords to buy them. And this manifests itself in various ways, of which my favourite way is the teachers of Tower Hamlets. The bottom tenth of London state schools do better than the whole of counties like Norfolk. You'll know these statistics. And there's been an incredible turnaround in the exam results. Tower Hamlets state schools do better than Oxford state schools. And there are various reasons. Immigration certainly helped. A little bit of government money helped. But the main one is it's remarkably easy to hire teachers in Tower Hamlets. And often they have a partner who's actually better paid than them because they're working in finance and in the city. So this bubble grows and it changes people's behaviour as it grows. And then at some point, of course, it's going to pop. And the faster it grows and the bigger it gets, the bigger the pop will be. Oh, that's an old graph. I was hoping to show you the Piketty one. Forget that one. And I can keep on time this way. Let's end with this one. This is just a UN projection of change over time and the point we're in, just to give it a bigger context. This thing is going to end. It cannot carry on at the rate it is going forever. It's already surpassed a whole series of plausible heights of what can be done. We have a quarter of families in England privately renting, up from 10% just 10 years ago. After London, the only other city with a big increase in jobs was Edinburgh. I mean, it is getting more and more ridiculous, but the problem is, as it gets more ridiculous, it drives the process on further until the point there's a crash. People don't want to know when there's going to be a crash. The whole point of crashes is you don't know when they are going to be. It's entirely conceivable. I mean, housing markets often crash in the autumn after people have desperately bought that home to get their kids into the school that might give them a chance in the future, because you're in an unequal country, so you can no longer go to the local school. But it's conceivable that this carries on all the way through until the first set of graduates with the £50,000 loans enter the housing market. In a way, what higher education have done is we've very sneakily taken out part of their future mortgages to keep our jobs. That's why we have £9,000 fees a year, because we basically kept all of our jobs. We didn't have the kind of cut the military had. And so sometime between now and, say, 10 years, when all those graduates who've got those massive debts enter the housing market, this thing is going to crash. And then we have no idea what's going to happen. But this is my story about London and the regions. And until that happens, you'll have this sucking in of London at an accelerating rate, because you'll be told you have to be there to have a chance if you're under 40, because there aren't opportunities elsewhere. There are parts of the civil service, there are departments in the civil service that employ 2,000-3,000 people and don't employ a single person under the age of 25 anymore outside of London. And that for me is the biggest change. And we just need to be aware of it, and what we should be doing is planning for what you do when that crash happens. Because you do want to have a sustainable city, cheaper housing, good quality of life. For me, the best place to look in the world for this is Tokyo. Tokyo had a house price rise that was slightly faster than the rise we're seeing in London in the 90s. Tokyo, until last year, was the most expensive city in the world. London's now overtaken it for a large city. Life didn't end in Tokyo when property prices halved and have stayed at half what they were for the last 20 years. And so I would look to Japan and for Tokyo as a model of what is possible for when the crash happens, when all this attempts to tell people not to be silly ends. And last thing to say, partly why people are being silly, is that since the early 90s, the number of mortgages has been going down. So people in their 30s, late 30s, even early 40s, are taking out massive loans to buy rather crappy property, because the alternative is being a private tenant all your life. And that's the kind of Ponzi scheme I think we're currently in. Thank you very much for your patience.